Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Guys, it's Emily Jane Fox. I am here with my co-host, Joe Hagan, Inside the Hive. Another week we did it, Joe, but I feel like maybe just barely this week.
You know, I'm trying to just get through day by day and mainly grapple with apocalyptic nightmares. Ever since I read this article in The Week that Matt Drudge put on the top of his headline a week ago, The Dark Decade Ahead by this writer, Matthew Walter, who describes, he says, we are not witnessing the long rumored revenge of nature, but a way of life that is always that was always unsustainable, extinguishing itself. You know, gee, that's not what I needed to get through the night.
That's a real kick in the pants.
It's a kick in the pants. I feel like, you know, on the one hand, there are the myopic day-to-day news details that we read on Twitter and on our Facebook feeds and the New York Times. And then occasionally you pan back and realize that we're in this sort of slow-moving tsunami of change that we can't quite get our hands around. And there's all these sci-fi visions come into my head. So I try to cling to silver linings like this recent news about, you know, coal burning way, way down and helping reverse some of the climate change that we've, you know, was another nightmare scenario that we already had. That's how we get through day by day, is with grappling with the big picture and then with your small picture between your four walls.
How's your small picture going?
You know, it's actually not that bad. You know, I have children, so on the one hand, I'm running a small one-room schoolhouse. It's a little bit like little...
You're also wearing your daughter's sweatshirt. I'm going to call you out on it. I'm seeing Joe.
Please.
He's wearing the coolest sweatshirt I think I've ever seen, and it turns out it was his daughter's.
My teenage daughter ordered this oversized hot pink Stranger Things sweatshirt that she decided she didn't want to wear, and so there it was lying around. I put it on. It fit me just. And she recoils in horror when she sees me wearing it, which is part of the amusement for me.
Well, that's you running a schoolhouse.
That's right. I feel like I'm in like Little House on the Prairie or something. You know, I'm just sort of like we're all in our own little isolated, prairies dealing with our people, you know.
Sure.
But it's all...
We've only got dogs over here.
Yeah.
Dogs all the time.
Right. And the dogs are looking at us like, you used to go away and now you never go away.
I'm very worried about the separation anxiety after all this is over. I feel like we have a puppy, and this started when we only had the puppy for exactly a month. And I don't think that she's going to know what to do when we leave the house. She doesn't know anything else.
Yeah. I'm glad that you're able to look forward and think about the day you'll leave the house.
I mean, I guess she'll be 17 by the time we leave the house.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's how I feel this week. I will say I greet your apocalyptic visions with anger of my own and maybe a bit of confusion, because I feel like for the first however many weeks of this until this week, six weeks, I don't know. Time is not real. I feel like everyone I knew or followed on Instagram was being really careful in a way that I was so impressed by, that everyone just with a snap of a fingers and a rule from the governor just changed their way of thinking and acting and doing. And this week I'm starting to feel like people are saying more and more, well, do you think it's appropriate to, or do you feel comfortable with to hang out in your backyard? Or do you feel comfortable with the idea of going somewhere this summer, or maybe renting a house together. And I don't feel comfortable with it. I don't. And I don't want to be a stick in the mud when I say that. And I don't want to come down like a school marm. But I think that our country is very much still in the middle of this. And I think we're going to be in the middle of it for a really long time. And that's with everyone being super careful and social distancing in a real proper way. Now, I know that being outside is probably the best place it could be if you're going to ease up on some of these restrictions and regulations. But I think that we all have responsibilities to ourselves, and I think we all have responsibilities to one another. And it makes me nervous to think that people who I think are really careful and really smart and really reading a lot about this are getting so tired of this already. We're just at the beginning of this.
Right. People are desperate. They're desperate.
And I think I know that this week I'm in Los Angeles, and a city official said something like, we've got at least 3 more months of this. And people freaked out. Like, people were not okay with the idea of it, but I hate to break it to them. I think that it's going to be a lot longer than 3 months. I think that if a politician were to say to you right now, you know what, guys, I think we're looking at least a year and maybe more, there would be a revolt. There would be a revolt. You can't have a politician saying to you, for at least a year, you're going to be in some version of what you're doing right now, and schools probably won't open, and restaurants won't look the way they look. And yeah, like, maybe you'll be able to do curbside at your clothing store or furniture store, and maybe construction will start up again, and maybe some more people will be able to go to the office in a restricted kind of way. And so it may not look exactly like it looks today, but life won't return to normal for a year or 18 months or 2 years. If someone were to say that to you, there would be just total chaos in the world. And so I think when people get freaked out about 3 months, it's like, what, read between the lines there, guys. It's not 3 months that they're telling you. It's an indefinite period of time. And so if people are getting restless now, I worry about what's going to happen in 3 months. That's my...
Yeah, well, we've got Dr. Fauci's out there, you know, giving the... he's ringing that bell that this is bigger than you're acknowledging, you know, in a kind of to counter Trump's completely fact-free version of reality. I already have friends who are proposing, you know, social pods in which, you know, they're actually using it as a verb, podding. Let's pod, you know. That means like three families would... you know, lock arms and, okay, we're all going to, you know, try to be careful and trust each other so that we can have any kind of social life. And I'm a little skeptical of that. You know, who can you trust? You never know what's going to be coming in from any direction. And it's sort of funny that we're having this conversation. We're being so careful. You and I live in these, you know, I live on the Eastern Seaboard. You're in LA, and we have like we're suffering more than other places in the country, and just in terms of concentration of illness.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you look out to places like Colorado, and there's a restaurant that opens, and it's like, you know, jam packed with sort of Trump voters who are sort of defying the whole thing, and they don't care. And they are probably in less of a position to have to care, perhaps, just given how much is going on in their area. And I kind of see our struggle being different from their struggle, and it's going to have political ramifications. And
yeah,
you already see Donald Trump, you know, coming up with distractions for his base to get, you know, worked up over, like Obamagate, which is the most ridiculous thing I can imagine.
How dare you talk about something our president did that way, Joe? You bite your tongue.
Yes, I'm sorry. I please forgive me.
I saw someone say on Twitter, which is a great way to start a sentence, that Obamagate is a sign that Trump knows he's not doing well.
Yeah, I actually believe, I buy that, and I'll tell you my argument, but you tell me yours first.
I just feel like, I guess with re-election is the one place I may disagree with myself, because I think he does have a good understanding of his base, and he does have a very keen sense of what it takes to win and a strong desire to win no matter what it is. But I think generally when people prescribe this great strategy to Trump, they're wrong. Like,
No.
there's no great strategy to him distracting people with his tweets and him saying this to get that. He just kind of flies by the seat of his pants.
Right.
That's my analysis. Though I think elections are one way that may not be true. I think that it's just bananas. You had Michael Flynn this week. You have Obamagate now. I don't know that there's really an appetite for this, I guess, on Fox News, but who cares?
Well, that's
We're living through a pandemic.
I agree with you, but he is a hammer without a nail, right? Obama, I mean, Biden is not there for him as a kind of, as a target. You know, he's just gone underground. And so I think that, you know, strategically, if you want to call it that, Trump is looking, he can't fight COVID-19. He's failed utterly, and he has to find another battleground to distract his base. And he sort of pulls out, like, you know, Obama. And Obamagate just seems like, wasn't that season one? I think that we're done with that storyline. I don't think that's going to work. I think it's too boring even as a conspiracy theory distraction. You know, I don't think people are going to go for it. And also people have other things to think about, you know, like the things we're talking about.
If our Justice Department does go down this road, but they've let Michael Flynn off. What a weird, wacky, scary, dystopian world.
Back to my apocalyptic scenarios.
Truly,
my apocalypse. Yeah, I mean,
it's not even the apocalypse. It's probably the reality.
Right.
We're going to listen back to this podcast in 3 months from now, and we're going to say, see how naive we were?
Yeah. But here's a question I have, and this is a question I'll just throw out. I'll throw out to you and to anybody listening. And if you're listening, come visit us on Twitter. You know, Emily Jane Fox, Joe Hagan, we're there. Be just curious what you think. Why, you know, Trump wants to win, and that's all he cares about, and he can't really see into the future too well. You know, to see what he would be presiding over as the president of his next term, which is a completely collapsed and decimated country. Like, why would he desire to be in power and have that hanging on him? I mean, it's kind of unusual now. I'm thinking about what kind of country he's going to be president of. Is power so, you know, intoxicating that you'd want to be in control of a country that's on a downward trajectory?
My take is that power is so intoxicating, the actual job is not. And I think more intoxicating than anything is the win for him. I think if you told him he could win and not be president, that would be the ultimate.
Yeah. So here we are. You know, we're desperate to get together with our friends, but we can't. We're coming up with, like, and spring is here, and that's a real tough one on the East Coast because we've had a cool, cold spring, and now the sun's coming out, and you want to get out and hang with your friends. You might want to get on a subway if you're living in New York City and, you know, go to Central Park. And yet now, can we get on the subway?
We can get on the subway. I don't know that I would, but we can get on the subway. I'm not alone in my fear. Ridership on the MTA is down 92%, which is wild to think about. Yet they're still operating mostly on a full service. I think it's 75% of their service. They have made the historic decision to shut down every night between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. in an effort to both clean the subways and also the city's homeless were really using the subway as an underground shelter. And this was an attempt for them to address that problem in the city. Our guest this week is Sarah Feinberg, who's the interim president of the New York Transit Authority. She worked in the White House under Obama as the White House grappled with H1N1 swine flu in 2009. She was the head of the railroads. She was chief of staff of the Department of Transportation. She's someone who understands this world so well. And I got to ask her a lot of questions about the future of the MTA. I know that this week we saw Twitter and some banks grappling with the idea of working from home forever. Why pay a gazillion dollars every year for office space, particularly in Manhattan or other major cities, if you can do the job from home And if so many people are able to do the job from home, what does that mean for our transportation system, which get most of their revenue from people crossing through tolls and over bridges and underground? And Sarah and I got to talking about really what the future of transportation looks like and how that will be funded and how that will be cleaned. She said something very interesting to me that actually made me miss the subway for the first time. Like, maybe not miss the subway, but long for a day where I could see the subway. She said that she's riding the subway to work most days, unless she walks. It's warm enough to walk. And the subway is shining like the top of the Chrysler Building. I'll believe it when I see it, but I have no reason to not believe her. She's the one who's running it. So I'm really excited for you to hear the interview. Would you get on the subway right now?
Absolutely not. I'm not even sure I'd go to the city. But I'd have to see these clean subways to believe it. But I do know that there's 8 million people who are going to be interested to hear what Sarah Feinberg has to say.
Let them all listen. Oh, one thing she did say before you guys all listen that I just want to put out into the world. I have a request for her at the end of the interview, and you all will get there. But I'm curious for you guys, if you guys have requests for what your dream new vision subway would look like when this all gets there. My request was for never having to touch those things in the station. I'm already a crazy person about them. Like, I would use something between my finger, like a tissue or a receipt or something like that. And so my request to her was never having to touch any kind of thing to buy my MetroCard. So I'm curious what your requests would be.
I'm going to let you know after I hear this interview.
Okay, let's get to it. I am so grateful that we have Sarah Feinberg as our guest today, because there is literally no one who I can think of who's more at the nexus of all the big things that we're facing today, from coronavirus to public transportation, evolving workplaces, and how an actual functioning government handles a pandemic and economic crisis. Sarah has been serving as the interim president of the New York City Transit Authority for the last 3 months. Quite timing. She has served as the president of the Federal Railroad Administration and as the chief of staff of the Department of Transportation. She has also worked as a special assistant to President Barack Obama and as a senior advisor to his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, where she advised on the administration's response to the swine flu pandemic and on economic recovery after the last Great Recession. Sarah, I know how busy you are, so I'm so grateful for you spending a little time with us here. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so glad to talk to you.
What a list of things you have done in your life so far, and what timing you had on starting your job, I believe right at the beginning of March, to step in as interim president. I can't tell if that's the best timing or the absolute worst timing in the world, and I think you probably have a better sense of that than I do.
I know. The timing was crazy. I mean, it had started, obviously. People were talking about it. People were familiar with COVID, but there was definitely, absolutely zero sense that it was going to become what it became in New York, and what it has become in New York. So it's both, terrible timing and also great timing. I mean, it's terrible timing because, oh my gosh, all the things I was going to do feel like they've been thrown out the window, and it's 24/7 on COVID. But, it's also, I think, people who, love to serve the public, who love to be public servants and love government roles, they want the ball in big moments like this. And so, if I were not inside, I would be reading everything I could get my hands on and probably emailing people unhelpful suggestions and volunteering for task forces, things like that. So
I'm sure they'd be glad to have you volunteering, but I can say so many people are glad that you are not just volunteering and not just sending emails, that you are the one who's in the thick of this as you're making all these big decisions. You just brought something up that I have been thinking about as I prepared for this, and that is the fact that you had all these big plans when you came in. You had been on the board of the MTA before this, and you had been a pretty activist member of that board. You had a lot of big things. What are the things that you've had to sort of put on the back burner because there's just no room on the front burner with coronavirus right now?
Well, you know, first of all, the accessibility of the system is really important to me. So I spent about a year on the MTA board before taking this job. And before that, I served on the Amtrak board. And I just, in my life, become very frustrated with how inaccessible our transit system is and many transit systems, you know, sort of around the country, and not just transit systems, but just the cities themselves and buildings. And I just think about that all the time, how, you know, there's a whole portion of our population that is, you know, spends their many of hours a day in a wheelchair, or they're pushing a baby stroller, or they've, you know, they're walking with a cane, or they have some kind of impairment that makes things more difficult for them. And you know, for New York City to have a transit system that is not welcoming to all people from all walks of life makes me a little crazy. And so that was something I was going to spend a lot of time working on. You know, I have a 2-year-old, so she's rarely in a stroller these days because she feels strongly that she should walk everywhere. But she was in a stroller for a really long time, and I struggled with that. And I always just had the view that this is so temporary for me, because at some point she'll be walking and, you know, we'll just be holding hands walking up these stairs. But I just always was thinking about folks who, you know, are dependent on elevators and escalators. And so, yeah, so when I came in, that was going to be one of the big things I focused on. And we just had passed a capital program where we were going to throw a ton of money at it. And we were going to make, you know, more than 70 stations accessible. And, you know, and it was just one of the things that we were going to do. Doesn't mean we're not going to do it now, but I can tell you that I haven't spent a lot of time on it the last 3 months, which is a bummer.
I can imagine that you've had that. There's nothing that I think could be more noble or pressing to the subway system as it is, or to any transit system, other than a pandemic, which happened to come your way.
Right.
What, 10 days in on the job was, or less than 2 weeks into the job, the entire city shut down. What was the atmosphere like when you first started, and how quickly did that shift once you were in the building?
So I basically decided to take the job within a day or two. It was a very quick turnaround. And, you know, it was my predecessor, Andy Byford, had resigned, and it was clear from the very beginning that we weren't going to have time to do a big search. We were going to have to find an interim person. And, you know, this sometimes happens on boards. You're the chair of the committee, or you're the chair of the board, and, you know, the person leaves. And so you suddenly find yourself being the CEO of the company. And so I sort of turned around on the decision pretty quickly, and it was the end of February, and I was going to start March 9th, and my family and I had this long planned vacation we were going to take just for like 3 days, just a couple of days, the week of the 2nd, to get away. And
Where were you going to go?
I know, we were like going to go somewhere warm, and it was going to be sunny, and, you know, March, we hadn't seen the sun in like months, and I was trying to protect that. I was trying to protect that time and then start a couple days later. And, you know, we hadn't been away since like August or whatever. And then within like a day, it was like February 28th or something. I was like, oh no, I'm not. Nope. That is not happening. This is like ramping up way too fast. And at the same time, I was like, also, I'm not taking my family on a plane right now. Like, I'm not going to get stuck somewhere and, you know, have a, you know, hotel decide that they're going to quarantine, you know, the hotel's going to quarantine itself and we can't get back and all that. So within like a day or two, I was like, oh yeah, I'm not taking that vacation anymore. And within like a day of that, I was like, oh, and I'm also going to start a week early. So I started a week early, and I call that the week that the taxpayers got for free, because I just sort of showed up and had to start executing, even though none of the paperwork was done. So it was just immediately all COVID all the time. I think maybe there was like a day that wasn't all COVID, maybe one day.
A one shining day.
One day. And then like day two, it was like, oh, I don't know why we thought we were going to have a meeting on that. We have to totally turn our shift to COVID. I think it was like my second day in the office, we announced that we were going from disinfecting stations once a day to disinfecting stations twice a day, which sounds kind of like an obvious thing that you would do, but we have almost 500 stations. And if you're disinfecting 500 stations twice a day, like the logistics, you know, and the workforce required are pretty significant. So
walk me through the logistics of making that kind of change and the workforce requirements. Are you, I'm presuming you're not hiring new people, but I'm presuming you're either dispatching people to do different things or having people work longer or more efficiently. I have no idea how you put into place something like that.
Yeah, so I work really closely with Sally Labrera, who is awesome. She runs the subway system, and she and I work really closely on these things. And so generally it just means that I'm calling her saying, okay, this is what we're doing now. What if we had to take it to twice a day? And she's like, well, we just can't. And I'm like, well, I think we have to. And she's like, well, that's, we're not going to be able to. And then, like, you know, within 20 minutes, she's like, well, actually, I think we could shift some things this way. And I'll say, well, what if we, you know, moved some people from the yard to the stations? What if we added a shift? What if we, you know, started moving people on trains instead of using their own vehicles? You know, you just sort of like, it's a huge logistical challenge. And it's like a puzzle. I mean, it's really fun too. It like definitely stretches that part of my brain. And, you know, how many cleaners do you have? How many contractors do you have? What shifts are they working? Where can you move them? What can they do? You know, do you have the equipment? Do you have the dispensers? You know, are they riding the trains at night? Are they, you know, how are they getting between stations? So it's a massive like logistical puzzle. It's pretty fun.
It's a lot of pieces that have to come together quickly and know that the pieces are people.
Yeah.
And that adds such a weight to these decisions. Are you still taking the subway to work?
Yes, most days. So sometimes I walk. Like this morning I walked because it was a beautiful morning and I had, and everything that was stacked up was calls. And so I walked this morning. But generally, yeah, I take the system every day.
Have you noticed a difference since March? I mean, obviously the number of people is down so dramatically. Besides crowding, have you seen people cleaning the subways? Have you noticed that the trains themselves are cleaner?
Oh my God, they sparkle. They shine like the top of the Chrysler building.
Little Orphan Annie had it right.
Right? I mean, they look so good right now. I'm so proud of it. You know, the subway system has gone through a lot of ups and downs over the last several weeks. Some deep, dark lows that were pretty dark. And I feel like we're coming out the other side. Like we're not there yet, but I can see it and we're getting there. And I will say that right now, you know, having executed this overnight shutdown, which is totally unprecedented, and throwing all the resources at the cleaning and disinfecting and making sure everyone's leaving the system and then has to reenter it in the morning, it has made just all the difference in the world. I mean, the trains are sparkling, the stations are clean, and, you know, we are cleaning 24 hours a day, and it shows, and it's a sight to behold. If you're a New Yorker and you're listening to this and you haven't been riding the system, you know, come out and see it because it is beautiful.
I truly don't think I ever thought I would say this in my life as a longtime germaphobe, but you're actually making me miss riding the subway right now.
Yeah. It's
I never thought I'd say that.
Yeah. I mean, I love that. I love the system. I mean, it's, you know, it has its moments and it will make you like raise your fists in fury, but, you know, it's like the great common denominator in our city. And, you know, it works and it's not always pretty and it can be kind of stinky and gritty and grimy. And, but like, you know, there's a lot of humanity down there. It's like
sure.
The common, you know, the thing that brings New York together.
America has a problem, one that is uniquely ours. On the new season of Long Shadow, I delve into the complicated history of firearms from the Second Amendment to the AR-15. I try to make sense of how we got here and how we might find a path forward. From Longlead, PRX, and Campside Media, in collaboration with The Trace, I'm Garrett Graff, and this is Long Shadow, in Guns We Trust. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to talk to you about closing the subways and cleaning and why that all happened. But you just said that there have been some real lows in the last couple of months. And I'm wondering what the lowest point was for you.
Oh, I mean, I spent a lot of evening commutes going back home after having been in the office, you know, until 8 or 9 o'clock or something, probably a little later than you want to be out in the middle of a desolate city in the middle of a pandemic. And just riding the system, and like the place just felt so desolate. And the few people who were out were clearly, you know, individuals, you know, either experiencing homelessness or experiencing like real mental illness. You know, we've been having this conversation for many months. You know, the folks who have nowhere to go still have nowhere to go during the pandemic. And so those are the people who are out, and, you know, they desperately need help, and they're not in a great place. And, you know, that was what the subway system felt like there for a couple of weeks. Because everyone else was home, as they should be, and no one else was out. And so that was, sure. those were dark days for the system. I feel like we're coming out of that, and I'm seeing, you know, I'm seeing more people in the system. I'm seeing a lot of workers in the system. I'm seeing a lot of essential workers in the system. I mean, personally, there have been many dark moments. I mean, we have lost so many men and women who work at New York City Transit. And so that, I mean, there were weeks when, you know, it was just one after another after another. And these are, you know, because I am new to this position, I didn't necessarily know them or work with them. But I've talked to their families, and I've talked to their friends, and it's the loss is incalculable for a family. And then, you know, you just worry about your own family. And so I've had, you know, plenty of those dark, you know, mom moments when you're worried about your own family.
Sure. And you, at the start of all of this, you had to quarantine a little bit. Is that right?
I did. Yeah, I had to quarantine for 2 weeks. So just within a couple of days, I think it was probably about a month into, it was about 3 weeks into the job, maybe a month into the job, three different people I worked really closely with got sick. And so I was sort of triple quarantined, which, you know, at that point was, I mean, it was challenging from a work perspective. But honestly, at that point, I was so deep into the COVID world that I like knew that I felt healthy and I didn't have any symptoms. And I knew that while I had been exposed, like they were meetings and conversations, not like someone in my family was sick. So,
So
it was more just a work challenge more than anything else.
Yeah. Well, you are managing, is this right that you're managing 51,000 employees?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is a huge, I mean, I don't think people understand how large this agency is. So all of MTA is 72,000 and New York City Transit's 51,000, depending on how you count, 53,000. And so it is, you know, running a massive, massive company.
Sure. Now, at first, when things really started to shut down in the middle of March, there was a lot of public outcry from some of the employees who were concerned that the safety precautions weren't up to the standards they felt comfortable with. Some said that train operators were not wearing masks and they were asked not to because they didn't want to scare riders off of trains or off of platforms. But at the same time, CDC guidelines at that point were telling people that they didn't have to wear masks. And in fact, some public officials were saying, don't buy masks, don't wear masks, save them for their healthcare professionals. So there are these conflicting desires and conflicting messages. And I'm wondering what it's like to be in charge of, it must be incredibly frustrating to be in charge of 51 or 53,000 people and having conflicting guidelines from our government, from public health officials. I don't know how you decide what to tell your employees if that's the case.
It was so frustrating. I'm still so personally angry about it. I mean, I and you know, I have a long history in federal government, and so I believe in government. I believe in government that, you know, takes a posture of, you know, taking actions that are supposed to help people. So from the very beginning, you know, when this whole thing started, you know, there was starting to be some noise about, like, folks wanted to wear masks. And I just remember being like, guys, the CDC says we're not supposed to wear masks. I mean, we're, you know, they're only for healthcare workers, and the medical guidance is they will, if you are not ill, it only increases your likelihood that you will end up sick, because you'll be touching your face and you'll be moving the mask and you won't be wearing it properly and all that stuff. And so I was like, look, we're a transportation agency. We're not a medical agency or a health agency, so we're going to follow their lead. And, yeah, there was a memo that went out because we had some folks who wanted to wear a mask anyway, and we sort of talked about it. And we were like, well, and it was a big debate internally, because I was like, I could kind of go either way. I don't really mind. But there were other folks who were like, eh, you know, it's not a great look, because we're telling people that they don't have to wear masks. And so then if we've got employees who are wearing masks, then other people are going to be like, well, if he's wearing a mask, why aren't we wearing masks? And anyway, pretty quickly, it just felt like a race to the bottom. And so, you know, I just sort of was like, well, the medical guidance is don't wear a mask. So that, I can't imagine we're going to be anywhere other than that. And then it just kept going and going and going. And it just, and I started personally being like, I didn't buy masks for my family. I didn't buy a mask for myself. Like, I should have, you know, I could have gone on Amazon with everybody else in February and March and bought masks, but I didn't do it because I thought I wasn't supposed to. And I think people were increasingly kind of thinking, how is this possible? Like, why is this the medical guidance? But, you know, I'm not a doctor. And then I will never forget, like, Pat Foy, the CEO of all of MTA, and I were preparing together for some kind of press. I don't even remember what it was. And we were discussing that we were just still on this bind. And we kind of looked at each other and we were like, let's just start distributing masks. Like, let's just say we're going to do it. And what's the CDC going to say? Like, it's become really obvious that you're clearly not putting yourself in harm's way at this point if you're wearing a mask. So let's just do it. And, and you know, if they tell us that we're making a terrible mistake, then they tell us we're making a terrible mistake, but we're like on the leading edge of this crisis and there's no one to follow. So let's just do it. And we just did it. And we announced it that day. And people were sort of like, what the CDC says, you shouldn't do this. And we were like, that's where we are. I mean, it's not right to just keep listening to that guidance when it's clearly not right anymore.
What's scary to me is if you're you and you've already been misled or sent down a path that you didn't feel comfortable with by our public health officials, by the CDC, by the administration, how are you to trust them again? If they're telling you guidelines now that are soon going to be later revised and you will have put tens of thousands of people in harm's way because of those guidelines, how can you trust these people again to put your safety and put your own health in the right path?
Yeah, I mean, having worked in a White House and worked closely with the CDC, I sort of couldn't believe where we had found ourselves, because I know that the CDC is better than that. But it was just, I remember sort of going home that night and being like, I don't know why I'm surprised, because this is sort of what government has been like the last couple of years. Like, you know, they're not on your side. You know, like, I keep having to remind myself of that. Like, they're not here to help you, which is, you know, I can't tell you how much it pains me as, like, a government person to have to remind myself all the time that, like, the federal government is no longer here to help you. You are on your own. They don't care. Look, obviously, that's probably too sweeping for every person in the federal government, but that's how it's felt during this crisis, for sure. And that is obviously how it's felt under this administration for a long time, for New Yorkers, for women, for parents, for, you know, regular people.
Sure. So what kind of safety measures do you then, as an expert who has spent a lot of time in government and I think is a responsible leader, what do you do to protect your workers now?
So we are basically doing all of the obvious things, and constantly figuring out what we can do on top of that. So we've passed out tons of masks. I think we're at like 2 million masks and, you know, several million gloves and hand sanitizer and, you know, reminding people to wash their hands. And, you know, that's sort of like first level common sense stuff. And then sort of next level is a bunch of stuff that we did in March. And I guess going into April, you know, that might not be obvious, but that we were just trying to do everything we could to protect the workforce. So we started having people board buses only in the back, not in the front, so that they weren't, you know, literally walking up to the operator and then walking by him or her. So we did rear door boarding. We stopped taking cash in our booths, not because we necessarily felt that cash was necessarily transmitting the virus, but just the less human interaction you can have face-to-face when someone's sort of, you know, trying to yell into a booth, we thought, you know, the better. We took those measures. And now we're sort of at a point where we're just open to anything. So the other thing we did is we barriered off a lot of space between the bus operator and the riders to protect the operator a little bit more. So we're sort of open to anything at this point. We are doing all of those things, and we're also just trying to figure out, you know, what's in the realm of the possible as ridership comes back. You know, is it distributing masks? Is it distributing sanitizer? Is it, you know, what kind of social distancing? You know, we have spent a lot of time thinking through how we can help our workforce social distance. So, you know, these are folks who are gathering in crew rooms and break rooms and, you know, small spaces where they are, you know, doing sort of a fitness for duty check. And, you know, before they go off and operate a train, or they're checking in at a depot before they operate a bus. And these are close quarters. And so what can we do to make sure that people are able to maintain social distance and steer clear of each other? We're doing temperature checks. We have like a temperature brigade that goes out and takes the temperatures of thousands of people every day. All of that. It's an all of the above approach to try to make sure that we're doing everything we can.
Sure. The thing that I think about all the time in terms of everything related to the virus and people who are going to work right now, but particularly for your workforce, is that there's such a stratification between people who have the luxury of listening to the stay-at-home orders, of working from home, of not having to get on a train or a bus every day, and the people who, A, don't have the economic option to stay home. Their jobs require them to be there in person. And B, you know, the people who are coming to work every day for you guys are really an essential service. They're keeping subways and buses running for doctors and people who are first responders and police officers and firefighters.
Right.
And it's just such an economic stratification between the people who can really protect themselves by staying home and people who have to protect the rest of us by going to work.
Right. And so, and I think that became obvious, you know, that became obvious to everyone a couple of days into this thing. Not everyone at MTA, I mean the world, right? Because the order was stay at home, and you quickly realize that if you can stay at home, what a luxury. You know, you might be annoyed and stir crazy, but what a luxury that you can either perform, you either can go without performing your job, or you can perform your job while protecting yourself and your family. And I think, you know, one of the interesting pieces of all this has been certainly the you know, the recognition that transit workers are heroes and are first responders in this case, and certainly essential workers. But, you know, when you become a police officer or a firefighter or a nurse or a teacher or a doctor, you sort of know what you're signing up for. You, like, raise your hand and you say, I'm deciding to go into a line of work where I will put other people's lives in front of my own. I will, you know, take a bullet. I will run into a burning building. I will... And that is not necessarily what transit workers signed up for, right? And and that is not a criticism. That is just like, you know, pharmacists don't sign up for that. Lawyers don't sign up for that. You know, we have like an unbelievable workforce that signed up to operate trains and buses because it's a great job. It has great benefits. Their dad did it. You know, it's a good life. They love trains. They love the subway system. They love transportation and buses and being out in the city and seeing all walks of life. They, you know, that is what they signed up for. And all of a sudden, here we are in this pandemic. And, you know, it's like now you're on the front lines of fighting, you know, a global crisis. And you have to show up and you have to be exposed to the public. And you have to, you know, if you're a conductor, you have to pull into every train station and stick your head out the window at every train station that you're in, you know, and look for riders and then pull back out. And so it's just like it's constant exposure. And I think it's been, incredibly stressful and eye-opening for, not for the people who work in this building, because we all knew it, but for the rest of the city and the world.
Well, you talked about this before, but one of the things you're doing to both protect your workers, but really to protect the riders, is by shutting down the subways. Now, in 116 years of the subways, this has happened before. This isn't the first time, but it's one of a few times, and you're doing it every night. The subway is no longer 24 hours a day. It is closing between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m., right, which I can imagine is a gigantic undertaking. And it came after the Daily News published photos and an article that showed a really dilapidated, dirty-looking system where there were, you know, I think there were 2,200 homeless New Yorkers who were staying on trains each night, and it wasn't allowing for you guys to clean properly. Right. Andrew Cuomo, governor, much celebrated, and I know you've had a long relationship with him. I think he referred to the photos that ran in the Daily News as disgusting. Yeah. I'm wondering what your reaction was when you saw the photos and saw what was going on. And then what happens when you decide to shut the system down? How do you go about doing that every night?
Yeah. So my reaction to the photos and the press coverage, frankly, was finally. For a year as transit chair of the MTA board, I was holding this problem, saying like, how come the transportation agency, the transit agency, is the one holding the bag on the homeless problem in New York City? And, you know, we've got a mayor that talks about solving the homeless problem all the time. And we've got homeless advocates, and we've got, the advocacy community. And yet, the MTA seems to be the ones who are housing everyone, you know, and the shelter system is broken and no one wants to be in it, and it's dangerous, and it's doesn't seem to have like right-sized to the problem. And so we've got thousands of people who are sleeping in our system every night. And that is, you know, that is so wrong on so many levels. First of all, it is wrong for people to be at a point where that's the decision, because the shelter system is so bad that they feel like they can't go there. And they feel like, you know, if they go to a hospital, they are, you know, helped for a short amount of time and then they're back on the street. And, you know, they can't go to other public space because they're kicked out, or, you know, the other public space options in the winter don't work. And so they're sleeping in, you know, a subway system, which is just, it's like such a clear abandonment of a population that like desperately needs help and that is so vulnerable. And it's such a failure of mental health services in this city. It just blows my mind. And, you know, it's a problem I've been dealing with for a year on the board and had been very frustrated with. And we had in fact set up a program almost a year ago that went into the system at night to the end of line stations and tried to get folks, homeless individuals, to accept services and go to shelters. But the reality was the process that we had set up wasn't working. And it was super frustrating to me because we were spending a lot of money on it, and it clearly wasn't making that much of a dent. Because these folks did not want to go to the shelters. And so when those pictures started coming out, I was frankly relieved, because I knew that it would be a forcing mechanism to have the policy conversation that I had not previously been able to make happen. So I had, you know, I had asked for meetings with the mayor. I had called and said, I want to talk about his transit priorities. I want to talk about how we can work together. And
did he set a meeting?
They just had not been engaged. They just, you know, every now and then I would talk to members of his staff, but they just were not. I think they've got a lot of problems on their plate, and I think they either consciously or subconsciously felt like the homeless problem in the subway system was inherently, you know, one that existed underground, and it was out of sight and out of mind. And as long as it was really the MTA's problem, that was a problem that they weren't going to prioritize.
Well, how could you effectively talk about the homelessness problem in the city if you're not addressing the homelessness problem on the subway? I don't know how you could possibly unlink the two of those things.
But look, I mean, I think the mayor doesn't ride the subway, right? I think a lot of the people who spend time with him, who either work with him or for him, may ride the subway, but they don't ride it at night. They're probably riding it, you know, during pre-pandemic times when there are millions of people in the subway system. And so individuals' encounters with someone who's experiencing homeless is something where you can just say, I went to the next car, or that guy didn't smell good, or boy, that was a disaster. You know, that seemed like a mess. And, you know, it was one experience in your commute last month or whatever. But they are not seeing it day in and day out, and it's not in their face like it is for, you know, folks who ride the system every single night, or for our cleaners whose entire job is to go into these trains and try to clean, and we're on a daily basis faced with folks who had treated our train as, you know, a shelter, or as a restroom, you know, or as their kitchen. And again, like, I want to be clear, like, these are folks who need significant help. My father was a longtime corporate attorney in West Virginia. His second act is running a soup kitchen. Like, we are a family that believes that you offer help, you are a public servant, you give a hand up, you give the last dollar out of your pocket, you help your neighbor. So I'm an absolute believer in that. But where we were in the subway system was, you know, at a place where we weren't helping folks. People were just avoiding it, and the mayor was ignoring it. And homeless advocates, I think, believe that it's a better option than, you know, a cold night in the city, which I understand. But, you know, the fix is not to let people stay in the subway system. The fix is fix the shelter system, you know, address the problem, you know, fix the housing crisis. It's not, well, that place, you know, the subway system's warmer, so let's just let it fester there. That is just, you know, it's just a, you know, you're just burying the problem.
Well, so, it's not even putting a Band-Aid on the problem. It's truly, as you said, out of sight, out of mind. It's not solving anything.
Totally. Yeah, it didn't solve anything. And so a big part of me was like, you know what? Great, because that's what this system is right now. While it's this desolate, while no one else is riding it, that's what this system has become. And it is so unfair to the men and women of New York City Transit who show up day in and day out, who, you know, are trying to operate a train or trying to clean a train, and it's like they're cleaning a bathroom stall, and it's just not right. So anyway, it was a really important forcing mechanism to make a policy decision, which I feel like is where we landed, you know, where the mayor and the governor had a couple conversations and just decided, you know what? We're not going to get people back into the system unless there's confidence in the system. And there's not going to be confidence in the system unless, you know, it is clean and people feel like, you know, they're not just seeing it, but they're feeling it and they're sensing it and they're smelling it. And so that's what we have to throw things at. And, you know, it's not an entire reopening strategy, but it's a piece of it. And I think we 100% made the right call. And, you know, to answer your question, it is a massive logistical undertaking to shut down a subway system overnight and then start it back up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was a sight to behold to see it all happen. And it took thousands of people, but it was an amazing sort of wind down of the system, and then you wind it back up.
It's pretty incredible. I feel like I wish there was a time-lapse video of it to see it happen in real time, because those of us who aren't you didn't get to see it, and I would just imagine what a feat it all must be and what it must look like.
Yeah, went to step off a train at an end of line station and have like not one, not two, but like 18 or 12 or whatever cleaners like snap in and like sort of surge into a train and start cleaning because they have to turn it around for like on like a 10 minute, you know, turnaround or a 15 minute turnaround. I mean, it's just awesome.
The people who are cleaning the trains are real heroes, and I'm so grateful for them.
No, they are. I mean, they totally are. They do great work.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarcella.
Putting bad guys away. There's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarcella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarcella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden. Listen to new episodes of The Burden starting March 19th on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
You mentioned that ridership is so down, and that's why this is a time to work on attracting new people. I think that ridership is down more than 90%. Mm-hmm. You're still operating services at about 75%, right? Like most of the lines are still running apart from the closure in the middle of the night. Most of the revenue that you guys bring in comes from people going through tolls or buying Metro cards. Mm-hmm. And then a portion of it comes from local taxes, state taxes.
Yeah.
You guys have already gotten $3.9 billion in grant money from the federal government to deal with what has happened to ridership since coronavirus gripped the city. You've asked for the same amount more, another $3.9 billion. The agency has said that they're projecting that for 2020 and 2021, there will be a budget hole of $10.4 billion. I'm wondering how you weather this financially with no one taking the subway as they took it before, with expenses for cleaning the subways going up, and no real clear picture of where revenue will come from.
Yeah.
How do you plug that hole?
Yeah, I mean, the short answer is that the MTA is probably too big to fail, and that will be like fingernails on a chalkboard to a lot of people, but I think it's the reality. I mean, New York City just doesn't work without a functioning subway system and bus system. I mean, this is not a city where people could choose to drive if they wanted to. I mean, first of all, you know, people, not everyone has cars. Second of all, even if the folks who did have cars decided to do that, you know, you'd make it about 15 minutes before you realized, like, you're literally never going to even make it to the gas station to fill up the tank of gas that you just ran through while you were sitting on the FDR. So, I mean, we just don't have the room for it. Congestion is too terrible. So it's just not an option. And that doesn't mean that we get to be, poor stewards of taxpayer dollars. It doesn't mean we get to be wasteful. It doesn't mean that, you know, we should do anything other than be incredibly mindful of every taxpayer dollar that's spent. But I just don't think it's not an option for the MTA to go bankrupt. It's not an option for the subway system not to operate. And look, the reality is that, you know, we can increase fares, we can do, we can try to run the system with fewer people, we can cut service, but that's all nibbling around the edges because the losses are so significant. At the beginning of this, I was thinking to myself, like, oh my God, I feel like this could be as bad as the financial crisis. And of course, the financial crisis is, you know, it's like a drop in the bucket compared to what we're all living through now. So I just think this is like the proportions are just astronomical.
And the thing that I think is different is that things, sure, they change, but they didn't change totally permanently after the financial crisis. And I think a hallmark of what we're living through now is that I think life will be fundamentally different in some ways after this. We're already starting to see that. Twitter announced earlier this week mm-hmm. that if workers want to work from home permanently, they can. And there was a great story in the New York Times about, a terrifying story that was very well written and reported in the New York Times, I should say, about banks and other employers in the city saying, we're probably not going to get back to the level of in-office working ever because real estate costs are so high. And so if you're not having people commuting every day, like they're commuting every day before all of this, I don't know what you do to account for a ridership difference. I can't imagine that you're going to have the number of people commuting every day that you had before. And that's an essential part of getting people on the subway.
Right. Well, I think you're right that it's going to take a very long time for ridership to come back. Like this isn't going to be, ridership is not coming back in 3 months or 6 months or a year. It's going to take longer than that to get back to, you know, to get back to real levels. But some of it has to come back because that's what people's options are. And if you live pretty far out, walking is not an option and biking is not an option for a lot of people. And Ubers become expensive really fast and taxis become expensive really fast. And, you know, people don't all have their own car. And so it just, we will end up with ridership coming back because that is the option, right? For a lot of people. I do worry that the system could become sort of the system that's used by the working poor, because I worry a little bit that everyone else will decide that they are working from home. Because what the New York Times story talked about, what the New York Times story didn't really capture is that when you start talking about banks and tech companies and huge real estate firms and, you know, the folks who, you know, like the big buildings on, you know, Sixth Avenue, you're talking about...
I guess
about,
most of them are not riding the subway anyway.
Yeah, well, a lot of those folks do ride the subway. It's totally true. But it's not that's not the majority of New York City, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of people in a lot of big buildings. There are tens of thousands of people. But there are a lot more folks who work in grocery stores and that clean office buildings and that, you know, work in restaurants and work in bookstores and work in retail and work in salons and work on construction crews and work at the MTA and do all of those jobs. It's not just, and those aren't work from home jobs. Like you don't get to work from home if you work in a nail salon. The future
totally.
Of nail salons is probably a different topic, but
I've been going about that for days.
Yeah. Again, it's the luxury. Like, who gets to telework? Not that many people. I mean, some people certainly get that luxury and that benefit, but everyone else is still going to have to get to work. I'm not sure. I mean, I think that we're going to end up being a culture that like takes advantage of outdoor space a lot more. I mean, I'm glad that the mayor has taken some steps to close a bunch of streets to traffic, and I think more and more there's just going to be massive demand for that. I think if you can close some streets and like expand outdoor seating of restaurants into the street, you know, you'll get people taking you up on going to restaurants again. If people's, you know, work can be done from tented facilities in Bryant Park, you know, then I think people will stay in the city and do work. But if the answer is sharing, you know, being next to somebody in a cubicle, people aren't going to feel comfortable with that. But, you know, if it's over 45 degrees or less than 100, I think people will be willing to be outside, you know.
Well, you see that in normal times. The second the weather gets above 48 degrees, you have people out in flip-flops on the street. And I think that people having been in their small apartments for months on end will just be so grateful to be outside, even if it's doing work or having a normal work day outside. New York comes alive when you're able to actually sit somewhere and the weather is not brutal. I really do see that as a way forward here.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what you learned in the White House. I know that you were there during H1N1, the swine flu in 2009. Is there anything that you learned in your time in that administration that you take with you now as you're working to sort of solve the puzzle that you're tasked with?
Oh my God. So, yeah, so much. I mean, just on the pandemic stuff specifically, I think the main thing I learned was the follow-on consequences of these things are just, you know, are multiples that you can't even see coming. So, you know, you sort of quickly get your head around like, okay, what are we going to do if like emergency rooms get overwhelmed? And if emergency rooms get overwhelmed, then what is the street outside the emergency room? And what is traffic? And, you know, you sort of start figuring out quickly those like immediate consequences if hospitals become overwhelmed, sort of what the governor has been going through very publicly, you know, what happens when you run out of ventilators. But it's like all of the follow-on consequences that are totally unpredictable, that that are really hard to prepare for, but that always come. So, you know, a good example is like when everyone leaves your subway system, what does your subway system become, right? I think we all predicted that ridership was going to go down to almost nothing. And in fact, I thought the most likely thing that was going to happen was that it would be important for me to be able to offer to the governor a tool. You know, if things get even worse, do you want us to shut down the system so that people cannot travel and so that people will sort of be forced to stay where they are? I thought we might end up in a dark place going in that direction. I did not.
Did you ever talk to the governor about that?
We many times presented all options. Like you can keep things the way they are, or you can take it all the way down to nothing. I think, you know, those were clear sort of, you know, offerings from the beginning, because you can toggle these tools in various ways to just make sure that, you know, you are always presenting the leadership with options so that they can make the best decisions they can make to keep people healthy. So, but I mean, I think a consequence that maybe it took us a minute to see coming was when ridership goes down, you know, who's in the system? And while I, you know, sort of saw desolate stations and like, could we end up with crime going up? Could we end up with burglaries? Could we end up with sort of general mischief? I'm not sure that everyone saw coming. Like, it could be that you just end up with folks in your system who have nowhere else to go. And who are experiencing some kind of mental issue, and then what happens to that mental issue when you're in like a desolate, empty train station?
Sure.
You know. So I think a lot of the sort of follow-on consequences of these big crises, and you know, generally just working in the White House, I had worked for Rahm Emanuel for years, and he remains like one, you know, probably the smartest person I've ever worked with. And so
I was going to ask you if you were speaking to him throughout this, if he's been able to offer any advice.
He's like a member of my family. We are very close, and so I certainly like ask him his advice sometimes, but our conversations are a lot of like, you know, like family kind of check-ins too. So, but you know, I learned so much from him, in the White House job, but also in all my other jobs, that, you know, I just felt like I was always, every day I was learning something.
Well, how do you think that this administration has done so far?
I think I've been so frustrated and disappointed, I think, like many people. I mean, you know, from the beginning, I tried to have high hopes and, you know, believe that maybe this would work out, that maybe decisions would not be based on politics, they'd be based on policy, and maybe, you know, we could come through this okay, and it would be a test of, you know, democracy and the American spirit, but it would all be okay. And I think, like a lot of people, I just am consistently disappointed, and, you know, it's particularly heartbreaking when, you know, you're someone who's devoted your career to government to watch it become what it has. But I mean, you know, this government has not been helpful to those struggling with this crisis. And, you know, I'm from West Virginia, so I grew up like in a coal state, and, you know, I think in a state that supported Trump by leaps and bounds, like huge margins. And, you know, I just watch his treatment of the people of my state, and it's just, you know, it's not government public service. It's not, you know, it's nothing that anyone promised. It's just, I mean, it's such a clear message to, anyone who's struggling, anyone who's not wealthy, anyone who's like working to get by, that, you know, I just don't care about you. You don't matter.
Mm. Yeah. And I think that you've seen, that's why you've seen government and governors and mayors and local officials step up to the plate so much, because there's been this real dearth of leadership from the tippy top. And I mean, you've seen it as much as anyone has, but people are obsessed with Governor Cuomo. There's a real Cuomozance after all this, and a Cuomomance, or whatever you want to call it. I'm wondering what it's like for you to see that as someone, I know that the governor appointed you to the MTA board.
Mm-hmm.
He's just, people are in love with him.
Yeah, I think it's funny because this is who he is. He's very good in a crisis. He's like decisive. He pushes people very hard. He's relentless. He's like everything you want in a governor in a crisis. And, you know, before all of this happened, you know, that element of his personality was like somewhat controversial in some parts of New York, because particularly in, I mean, we don't have to get too dorky here, but like particularly in like some pieces of the transit transportation world, people felt like he was too hands-on, that he should just get out of the way and let, you know, transportation policy folks do what they want to do, and he should not micromanage the subways, he should not micromanage the MTA, should not micromanage infrastructure projects. And I just was always like, man, you do not know how lucky you are to have a hands-on governor. Like, because the opposite of a hands-on governor is a governor that does not care about you, does not care about your problems, does not care about executing on his or her duties, does not care about what, you know, executing on what they were elected to do. The best thing you can hope for is a governor who's hands-on, who cares about your stuff, and who is of the same mind of you. You know, you're both Democrats, you're both progressive, that is like, it doesn't get better than that. And so I always felt like, you know, the folks who were complaining about him just, you know, to a great degree don't know how good they've got it.
Do you think that he'll run for president?
I don't know. I mean, I think he would be a great candidate, but I think his plate is full on the pandemic. And, you know, I know that he shares my view that when you are tackling like a challenge this big, any minute that you spend not figuring out the right way to get to the other side of it, is like, you've no business doing anything other than making your way through the challenge.
As we wind up here, I have a couple more questions for you. And I want to talk to you about all the work that you're doing and facing this challenge. I know that you are in this position as the interim president, and that you had said early on that this was not going to be a permanent job for you, that you have a 2-year-old, and this is a very tough job for someone with young children. Has that changed at all? Are you looking for a permanent replacement for the position, or is it all head down focusing on work?
You know, it's just heads down dealing with the work. You know, and I think, you know, I continue to think that this job is really hard to do unless you're going to just devote yourself fully to it 24/7, 365. And that's just not something I can do with a 2-year-old at home, nor is it something I should do with a 2-year-old at home. So I am still interim because I don't think you can do both the job and being a mom and being a partner well at this point. So either the job has to get a little bit more manageable, that's the option. The job either has to get more manageable or someone else has to come do it.
Do you think it's possible to make the job more manageable?
I think it's possible. I mean, look, we have to get through the crisis at hand. I mean, the consequences of what is looming ahead of us, even when we get through the current crisis, is so hard and so challenging. I mean, first of all, this is a workforce that's now lost more than 100 people, like more than 100 colleagues. And so we will find ways to honor each of them and all of them for their public service. But like that is still looming ahead of us. Like that is a huge thing that's impacting this workforce and this company. And there is trying to recover from the financial crisis that has, that is now sort of just trying to eat us alive. And there's, you know, the importance of convincing the ridership that they should come back. So all these are just massive, massive challenges. So I think it can become more doable. I think the job can become a little bit less 24/7. But, you know, we've got a long way to go. I mean, I don't think anyone who works with me has taken even one day off in like, you know, 10 weeks or something like that. You know, no Saturdays, no Sundays. I mean, people are wow. just working around the clock. So
is there anything that makes you hopeful, any kind of innovation or look that feels like a different idea that you will bring into this next chapter, whether it's once people start going back to work or once it becomes clear that a vaccine will hopefully come into ready availability for the public? Is there anything that you've talked to people about, that you've heard about, that makes you feel like, oh, this is a real innovation that could change the way that we clean the systems or the way riders interact with the systems? Is there anything that you're excited about implementing now that you've had time to really think about what the future looks like?
Yeah, I mean, there is. I mean, there's a lot to be excited about, honestly. I mean, first of all, you know, just pushing yourself and the workforce to the place that it's been pushed to just sort of discovers new talents and new achievements. So, you know, if you had told me we're going to have to shut down the system overnight, I would have said, okay, well, it's going to take us about 9 months to plan for that because we're going to have to make all these service adjustments. You have to make all these policy decisions about last trains and first trains and where do you pre-position, and, you know, we're going to have to do a labor pick so that we figure out who's operating trains when, and it would have taken us 9 months to plan and people would have, like, navel-gazed it to death. But when you say, and we're doing it in 3 days, you know, know it's not an option not to do it, you know, people sort of stand up and they just like say, okay, and they like take on the fight and they execute. And so that was like amazing to see that happen, because it was just like such a phenomenal, Herculean, massive effort to be able to do it. And we did it. And I don't want to like toot our horn too much, but like we like knocked it out of the park. I mean, we got like a 90% on the first night, and it wasn't perfect, but we told people it wasn't going to be perfect. And, you know, we've gotten better every day. And so that gives me like tremendous faith in the workforce just to be able to do that. You know, within like 3 days when this whole thing started, we sent thousands and thousands of people home on telework, which we're just not a telework place. We didn't have those policies
exactly.
in place. Yeah, we just didn't even have those policies in place because we didn't really want people to be teleworking. And so, you know, we executed on that in a couple of days. Is it perfect? Nope. Like, we need to go back and fix it and make sure that, like, everything is sort of running smoothly. But like, executing on that stuff is really hard, and so that gives me a lot of faith. There's some technological, I think there's some tech stuff that we can get to, which I think will be very cool. Like, I feel like we will get to a point where we can tell riders that the approaching train is at capacity or is below capacity, so they know if they should try to board it or if they should wait till the next one or if they should walk to the next station.
I'll tell you what I'm desperate for.
Okay.
I'm desperate to be able to buy a MetroCard without having to touch a touch screen.
Yeah. So you've been away too long because
I know.
Like, you need to come back and get your Omni on, because
that's the future.
Yeah, contactless. Over the last couple of days, I just was like, can we not find a way to let people, you know, go online, enter the serial number of their MetroCard, and like load money?
Want.
Yeah, I'm told it's impossible, but, you know, I'm frequently told it's impossible, and then you kind of have to dig into it a little bit and make sure. But I'm told that the magnetic strip actually has to run through the machine, which would be.
I'm counting on you to make that happen.
I know,
because I'm like, I am such a crazy person. For years, I feel like I am ahead of the corona curve, but for years I've been using, like, I keep like tissues or like old receipts in my wallet. And anytime I had to refill my MetroCard, I would like use the tissue or the receipt to touch the screen so my hand didn't have to touch the screen. Like I was a real maniac about it. I feel like now the world is catching up with me. I feel less maniacal, but I'm counting on you.
Well, I'm going to try to get it done for you. I will tell you that one thing I did not know before I came here to MTA was that, this drives me crazy. There are folks who will intentionally vandalize our vending machines so that it is either impossible to get a MetroCard, like it's jammed, you know, or they'll vandalize it in a way where it's not working, or they'll just put really gross stuff on it so that no one has any intention of touching it. And then they sell swipes by the turnstile. So they basically have an unlimited card or a monthly card or whatever, and they will stand there and sell swipes because people can't use the vending machines. And I just it's the lowest of the low. Like if you're doing that to the little old ladies in the Bronx and Queens, like, man, like we're coming for you. Like we're gonna throw the book at you.
I hope so. I respect the hustle, but I hate the game. Really, that's just so terrible.
Yeah, no, you can't even respect that hustle. Like that's right.
No, that is not a hustle. You're totally right.
Yeah, totally.
You are totally right. That is. We will both find you.
Yeah,
we're looking at you. Anyone taking advantage of
little ladies? Those guys listen to this podcast.
Right. I'm sure they do. That's our target audience.
Yeah, the hustlers.
Exactly who we're reaching every week. Sarah, I can't thank you enough for spending time with us. This was so incredibly helpful to hear about, and we are just so grateful to get to learn from you, and we're so appreciative of your service to the city.
I'm so glad to talk to you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Take care.
Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
Thanks to my guest, Sarah Feinberg, and of course, my co-host, Joe Hagan. If you enjoyed this conversation, please be sure to listen and subscribe to other great episodes of Inside the Hive. You can find these on Apple Podcasts, radio.com, or anywhere you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review while you're there. Thanks to the folks at Cadence 13 for their production work. And of course, thanks to my sponsors. Please support them the way you support this podcast. And we'll see you right here next week.
Hi, I'm Michael Calori, the co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab.
And I'm Lauren Good, the other co-host of Wired's Gadget Lab. Get ready to dive deep into the cultural phenomenon that's been shaping conversations, sparking movements, and breaking barriers for over a decade.
The new three-part docuseries, Black Twitter, A People's History, based on the groundbreaking Wired cover story by Jason Parham, explores everything from the fun, games, and inside jokes that characterize the early years of Black Twitter, to the social movements, the voices, and the hashtags that made Black Twitter an influential force in nearly every aspect of American political culture. Join us as we unravel the threads of this digital community, tracing its origins, celebrating its triumphs, and exploring its impact on society at large.
Watch the series from Onyx Collective in association with Wired Studios, premiering on Hulu on May 9th.
From PRX.